I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
This episode is brought to you by Fulton Stall Market, reopening their outdoor market in the Seaport District in May 2021. Learn more at fultonstallmarket.org.
This week on Meat and Three, we're jumping into a world filled with fizz, iridescence, and deliciousness. We're talking about bubbles.
It came from the air gas truck. Yeah, no, I never thought about it before that.
And I think it's emerged as a bulbous tea shops, a site of Asian American youth identity building.
We're called the invisible industry because these products you don't really see, but they're around us in every way, every day.
Listen to Meat and Three wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio, on this journey through culinary history. And if I say the word Roma, do you know who I'm talking about? Roma, Romani, Gypsies, Gitanos, a lot of different names to describe an ethnic group that probably migrated to Europe from Northern India, but in Eastern Europe, the Roma are the largest ethnic minority. There was a movie recently called Roma, and that was the Mexican Roma. And throughout history, of course, we have an idea of who these people are, probably a stereotype, but we think of flowing, colorful dresses and dancing, music, maybe some fortune telling. And all that is indeed part of what went on and what there was, but it's so much more. And historically, in many of the European areas that the Roma migrated into, in the 1400s up until maybe the 1800s, the Roma were slaves. Many of them were taken as slaves, and we'll learn more about that. They've been in Europe for over 1,000 years. And today we're going to be talking about those who live in Spain called the Gitano. And there are an estimated over like 750,000 of these Roma or Gitanos living in Spain today. And my speaker today, has studied these people. He went and lived with them. My question when I read about them, and I guess it was his question as well, was, is there a cuisine? What was the food culture of those who settled in certain areas and specifically in Rome? Well, Valerio Ferris learned about the cuisine of the Spanish Roma and the importance of preserving the recipes and this culture by going there and cooking with them. Ferris is a culinary historian of New York Scholars Grant recipient, last year. And Valerio, you're there, so you can correct me if I'm wrong, but received a grant from the Culinary Historians. I should know that well since I'm part of that. And you spent time with the Roma activists and chefs in and around specifically the Barcelona area, focused on the Roma communities in Catalunya. And you studied the process also of collecting and archiving recipes and recorded Roma culinary history as a collaborative process, which I find really interesting. Now, Valerio is a food writer and a researcher and a cook, and you studied media at NYU and worked for a cheesemonger for a while before you pivoted into food media. And I first heard of you when you were writing for Food 52 as a staff writer. Since then, you lived in Barcelona giving tours of the city, and we'll get into that. I'm assuming that's kind of how you got into this culture, this group of people. But now you've since moved out of Barcelona and live in Berlin, where you work as a creative editor for the cooking startup Kitchen Stories. Fascinating. How did you come about wanting to learn about or studying the Spanish Roma? And tell us, we'll get into having you tell us more about them, but I want to know how you started it first.
Of course. Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here today. Yeah, I mean, I guess my arrival kind of at this topic was many, many, many years in the making. I grew up in the U.S., but I have a father who's from Italy. And so I spent all my summers kind of going to Europe and visiting my family there. And this word, or Roma, or in Italian they're called Zingari, was like a community of people that had never really entered my radar living in the U.S. And I remember kind of just like hearing them discussed in passing and whatever. Was always very confused because I didn't really feel like, especially when you're a child and you're learning both languages, like I'm constantly doing translations back and forth. And this was this one word that would kind of get tossed around and I would never really be able to kind of think of a counterpart or a perfect translation for where I was from. And though Roma do live in North America, the kind of presence was a little bit different. And fast forward a few years, or I guess many, and I was studying at NYU in Prague, actually, where they have a campus. And there was a class on the history of the Roma. And immediately I jumped into it, was super excited. It turned out to be kind of a smaller class because, again, a lot of North American students haven't quite heard of this community of people. But I was like, oh my gosh, this is finally my moment to kind of understand what's going on here and get a little bit more of historical context. Right. So that was kind of my initial introduction. And it was very an anthropological approach. It was super historical, looking at the way that Roma people have been talked about in academia and understanding kind of all the different ways that people have studied this community and also treated them throughout kind of history, but specifically the last two centuries, the 1800s and the 1900s.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you took this course and you learned so much about these people. Why don't you fill me in a little bit? For instance, who are they and, where did they come from? What are some of the more accepted origin theories of who these people are?
Yeah, of course. So historically, the Romani, which we'll kind of get into the naming of it all a bit later, but for the sake of just kind of ease of flow of conversation, I'm just going to go ahead and use Roma or Romani people. But they're historically a nomadic group of people living mostly across Europe. But of course, there are pockets across North and South America as well, just as a result of migration. Specifically, what makes them unique is that historically, they've never really identified with having kind of like a home territory. And they claim no tradition of an ancient or distant homeland. And there isn't really any kind of allegiance to a political project of establishing like a sovereign nationhood, which is why I think makes kind of this study super, super interesting, especially when you're talking about Europe, because you're seeing kind of a bunch of countries that are all intensely defining themselves around this concept of nationhood. And so especially as those nationalism projects were picking up steam, that's kind of when you started to see this tension really take place in Europe, because you have on one hand countries that are gathering around a flag, a shared language, this kind of vague concept of unity, mm-hmm. Bristling really intensely with people who are completely rejecting that.
All right. But they had to come. I mean, so the theory is they migrated from maybe northern India. I mean, they've been around for over 1,000 years. Now, I know that they first appeared in Spain around 1425. So what are some of the theories about where they perhaps came from?
Yeah, so most of the theories around where they originated from have to do or kind of were arrived at through the avenue of linguistics. So when you look at Romani, which is the language most commonly spoken in Roma communities, although that tends to vary from country to country, there's kind of a vague like commonality between all of them. So mm-hmm. in Romani, actually, the earliest or the most easy comparisons are to modern Indo-European languages of northern India.
So that was kind of what people were able to use to say, okay, here's kind of some type of origin theory. It's kind of in academia, it's called the Andean origin theory, to explain that Roma people supposedly left India in repeated migrations, and then moved into Persia by the 11th century, moved into southeastern Europe by the 14th, and then arrived in Western Europe by the 15th. Mm-hmm. Other people contest that and say that kind of to do this work of explaining origin, and especially explaining origin as coming from outside of Europe, increases the sense of otherness that Roma communities already feel. And so there's kind of these two camps in the Roma scholarship that I studied. One saying Indian origin theory, we can explain it through language. We can look at migratory patterns, and this is what kind of brought them here to Europe. And then there's other people saying focusing too much on origin is really just doing more othering work. So let's not even try to explain that. And let's more so just work on the current kind of tension that we have
curiosity gets the better of me, you know, wanting exactly. to explain it, but it's fascinating. I mean, just a fascinating history. You had mentioned that makes them out. They are such outsiders or the otherness, which only adds to what they encountered over the centuries, which was totally. A lot of historical subjugation and derogatory names. Gypsy being one, that's considered a pejorative name, right?
Yeah, so you see across all of Europe and every country different words for what we in English would use as the word gypsy. So you have Zigeuner in German, Zingari in Italian, Gitanos in Spain. And this word Roma was kind of, was agreed on by a lot of people within the community, but it was agreed on as kind of a source of some type of unity to create this idea of like pan-nationalism isn't the right word because it's not necessarily a nationhood, but to create this like idea of unity across different communities in different countries in Europe. The flip side to that is a lot of people saying that actually doesn't necessarily apply to me. Naming is always very tricky, right? And so yeah. With this, we see this whole thing of an individual. It seems like a good idea to impose this kind of concept of Roma. And I think a lot of people would agree with that. And when I was in the Czech Republic, actually, there was a lot of people identifying as Czech Roma. But when I was in Spain, I don't think I ever heard someone from the community ever call themselves Roma. They were always using the Spanish word for gypsy, gitano. Mm-hmm. So it's this idea of it would be nice and clean and easy to kind of have this one word that crosses borders. But again, this is not like a nice, clean and easy situation. So it's some people bristle actually kind of against the word Roma because it feels like this almost like weighted blanket that's supposed to kind of get rid of all the like bristles that exist. But actually a lot of people do kind of hold on to this original nomenclature that though in some cases is used in a derogatory way is actually what they more identify as.
Hmm. Well, in those travels and settling, I mean, they never really settled in one place and it wasn't because they were necessarily nomadic, right? But they got kicked out. I mean, they were told to move on. Initially, right?
It was a combination of both. They like historically did lead a little bit more of a nomadic lifestyle. And so there is actually, if you look at the Roma flag, for example, there's actually a wheel with spokes in the center of the flag. So there was this kind of like lifestyle via caravan and then establishing temporary settlements. So a lot of this was by choice, but a lot of this was also because of like forced resettlement at the hands of local enforcement. So it's kind of a little bit of a mix of both. And it was actually kind of this exact borderlessness and transitory nature that was kind of unsettling a lot of European populations and governments. And sure. It really helped to establish a stark difference between us and them or you and them.
Right. Well, tell me a little bit about the history of many of the groups who migrated to Europe.
Yeah. So I think that if we're going to have to talk about a little bit of the history of the Roma groups that migrated to Europe, it's going to be one with a long history of subjugation. So they became kind of scapegoats depending on where they live for a variety of societal ills. And their relationships with host countries were marked by a lot of contradictions. Oftentimes, and we see this happen kind of with Native Americans in the United States, in a similar way, but there was a lot of movements or motions to assimilate them into local culture. So rid them of their language, enroll them in local schools, and this kind of process from a younger generation up of destroying and erasing their culture. Hmm. Some other examples, just throughout history. In 1530, England issues the Egyptians Act, which banned Romani from entering the country and required those living within it to leave within the course of 16 days. In 1685 in Portugal, they deported Romani to Brazil. And then, of course, the largest kind of where it kind of is the tipping point was during the Holocaust, when an estimated 400,000 Roma were killed across Europe.
Yeah, I think that's something that no one is aware of, that there was this planned extermination of them.
I mean, besides the Jews, they were the largest group of people targeted by the Holocaust.
Right, right, yeah.
And amazing. I think that's actually, it's interesting because there is a lot to be said also about the comparison between Jews in Europe and Roma in Europe. There was this kind of borderlessness, community orientation to it, shared language, yes, Yiddish, but also shared religion. And then they both kind of came, and they were the same way that Jews were often blamed for certain societal ills or for plagues. There was a lot of kind of there's a lot of comparisons to be made between the way that they existed in Europe, both these two communities.
Hmm. The slave labor was something that caught my eye and interested me because of when you see representations of them, let's say in books or in film, it's always these same labor skills that were, mm-hmm. which were very much, you know, slave labor skills.
Yeah. Yeah, there was some history of Roma slavery in the Balkans. And then I think also you're pointing at something super important with the representations in the media. I mean, you're either seeing this type of hard work or you're seeing fortune tellers, palm readers, swindlers, this kind of like exotic, covered, like swathed in different fabrics, like tricky kind of stereotype that was super, super active and kind of continues to be. Mm-hmm. I mean, even so much as in my childhood, I had Esmeralda in The Hunchback of Notre Dame, mm-hmm. who was like persecuted in France for being a gypsy.
Yeah. I mean, and then I know some things that I read said some of those skills, as they tried to assimilate them into the communities, is that some of those skills would be outlawed and not letting them do that. Horse trading was a big one.
Yeah.
Right, as well.
Yeah.
And of course, music.
Music is actually a really interesting point as well, because especially the way that they're understood through most of like outside Roma communities is through music. So historically they've had a huge contribution to global music scene. In Spain, a lot of gitanos are credited with creating flamenco. People in like ethnomusicologists are always focusing on gitano communities or Roma communities in general across Europe because of their huge, huge, huge contributions to the music scene.
Right. And I mean, just make me think of so many different things that I see and read about them and which, you know, are often not true and not right. But yet that, you know, being the music, even though it's portrayed as being, you know, the dancing and the, you know, which of course there was, you know, the dancing mm-hmm. and celebrating. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were a very tight knit everywhere they went. Obviously they had one another, so they were a very tight-knit
community. Of course, right?
Yeah. So I would imagine there would be a lot of that. What mm-hmm. about food?
Yeah, what about food, huh?
I mean, they were never settled in one place long enough to, you know, to really develop a cuisine, right, of that area.
Yeah, that was my big question. And so when I was studying in the Czech Republic at my university in Prague, I'm in general very food minded. My parents owned restaurants growing up. My dad was a chef. And when it got time to get to my final project, we had to propose some type of research paper. And I remember asking my professor, like, can you point me in the direction of any information about like Roma food? Is I would love to kind of have some kind of more independent research based on this. Mm-hmm. And he looked at me and he was like, that's actually something that like really is not discussed. Food studies in general is kind of has only really emerged in the past few years as this like super robust academic discipline. Mm-hmm. And it hadn't kind of crept to the edges and kind of Venn diagrammed with Roma studies. And he was like, you're kind of going to have to do that on your own. So there wasn't really a lot of work or writing out there that existed, especially in a Czech context, talking about Roma food. And yeah, so it was a super interesting thing that I wanted to kind of learn about, because like you just brought up with the music, it's this cultural output that helps define a community, especially when they're lacking all the like traditional things that we think of as community defining, whether that be borders or a shared flag or a national anthem. It was all these kind of, I was thinking a lot of Benedict Anderson and Imagined Communities, all these things that we do or actions or words that we speak that make us. And I wanted to see maybe how food could kind of be one of those things.
Right.
And right. And also with this history of poverty, subjugation, mobility, spreaded outness, I guess, across the continent of Europe, how was that also affecting their shared food culture?
Right. So what made you choose Spain?
Yeah. So when I was in Czech Republic, I did that project and I met with a local Roma activist based out of Brno, which is one of the largest cities in the Czech Republic. And he, first of all, was extremely moved and extremely excited that I was even kind of asking the questions that I was. Mm-hmm. And met up with him, went to his house, and he showed me this like whole YouTube archive that he had made of him just cooking in his kitchen and feeding his family. And he would kind of show the food, just talk through the recipes. And I thought, oh my gosh, wow, this is actually exactly what I'm looking for. This is so beautiful. This person is understanding that if this goes away, I too in some way go away, or we do too in some way go away. And I just like, we really, really connected. And I wrote this paper and I just kept thinking about it, but I had to end up going back to school. It wasn't until a few years later that I was writing, this time about food, this time also up full time. And I thought, okay, now I actually have like a huge vocabulary to talk about food. What would happen if I revisited that project, reached out with that activist that I had met while I was in the Czech Republic, and started to develop kind of this line of thinking in a bigger way. I talked to the man in Czech Republic, but I did realize that ultimately, if I wanted to be as successful or get as deep as I wanted to, I was going to need a local language. And I speak Spanish. So I ended up, though kind of my earliest connections were in the Czech Republic, I ended up pivoting and focusing through a lot of connections that I made with them and them kind of connecting me with communities there. And I decided to relocate and make it happen in Spain. I just thought that on a personal level, I would feel much more connected. I could get the type of work done that I wanted to be able to. Yeah. And
delve a little deeper.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that was kind of what ended up shifting the focus from one country to another.
Well, and what I would imagine, and you tell me, and you know, your studies that looking at the food of this community, there's not just one food of that entire Roma population, because they're each different in each country that they migrated to, just as any ethnic community would
be,
group. So you're looking at influences of what's available, right? And what they're cooking and what's available. So a lot of Spanish influences in whatever other foods might be part of their background.
Totally. And it was something I realized super early on when I was doing my research. At first, I was trying to do this kind of large pan-European study, and I realized, first of all, not only is that not feasible, it is feasible, but having a long kind of time to do that. But what I did realize, and what a lot of people were telling me early on, is you can't expect the food to be the same in Eastern Europe as it is in Western Europe, in the North, in the South. It's going to change.
Right.
right. with the place. In the same way that Romani, the language, takes on from the place that they are, so too does the food. And so right. then that also was this whole line of thinking that actually kind of became one of my main research questions, was thinking, okay, one, what makes Roma food Roma? But then also, how is it interacting with the local cuisines where it's based? Right. So it almost made it even more interesting to kind of be able to think about that, because it's not like everything I've been saying, it's not this pan-European identity. It's this identity that exists, but also like convenes with the local identity where it's based.
Well, now you said you spoke Spanish. That's all great. But they spoke a Romani and a
yeah,
Spanish.
So most of the people where I was in, so for example, in the Czech Republic, they were speaking Czech and then they were speaking Romani in their community. Most of the Gitanos that I was meeting with in Spain were only speaking Spanish and Catalan, which is the language of Catalonia and Barcelona. So that was also interesting because I felt like there was a little bit more, I guess, of a historical connection in Czech Republic, and in Spain, they were just speaking the local language or languages.
Hmm. So all right. So tell me about the food.
Yeah,
that you discovered in Catalonia.
Yeah, of course. So I would not have been able to have accomplished or even have kind of delved as deep with not for the help of the Alicia Foundation, which is a food gastronomy research center and like center of innovation based out of Catalonia. It's about 3 hours north of Barcelona, probably an hour by car, but 3 hours by train. And what they do is they're kind of a multi-pronged organization. They focus a lot on nutrition, but they do have one arm that is devoted to kind of food history. And they had actually done or put together a book on Catalan Gitana cuisine, which was super perfect, super interesting for me. I got to go straight to the belly of the beast, met with them and had a really nice conversation with them. They had spent a few years traveling through Catalonia, archiving recipes, collecting stuff. Neither of the people who put together the project were Gitano, but they had kind of driven from town to town, met with community organizers, cooked with people there, and put together a cookbook of all the research that they were able to conduct while they were putting together their project, which was really, really helpful for me because this kind of the scope of work that they had done and the breadth of recipes that they were able to show me were super, super useful. And then they kind of were connecting me through their network as well.
Right. Were there many other documented, written, codified recipes from the Romani? Like, I mean, this Alicia project is phenomenal. You know,
it's phenomenal. It's also a super unique example. There isn't a lot of stuff that exists like this. Mm-hmm. And even when they were doing the research, they found that the Gitano people that they interacted with were extremely grateful and super surprised. And it was because it's also an extremely oral culture. They were the ones kind of writing these recipes down for the first time and doing stuff like watching them pour how much they go in and kind of like measuring the negative measuring the rest, you know?
Right.
So they were really kind of doing the recipe building from the ground up. And yeah, it was a super exciting project for them. And yeah, like you said, there's not a lot of examples like this, so much so that though they only did it in Catalonia, which is a province of Spain, they hope someday we're given the funding to take the project countrywide and drive across the country, visiting different Gitano communities across Spain and doing this. So yeah, it's important to say that the research I was doing or the people I met with are Gitano communities only within a Catalan context. So that's a region of Spain. But it's kind of being like, I guess, because I'm based in Texas, coming to the U.S. and saying that you're doing research in the U.S., but exclusively in Texas, as we know, is very different than the rest of the U.S.
Well, you know, you've got to start somewhere. I mean, it's project. You've got to start small and then grow from there. And I think that, you know, that's the best way to do it. I want to hear specifically about some of the recipes, some of the types of food and the cooking project. Right after we take a quick break. So we're gonna go for a quick break, but stay tuned. We're gonna be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Fulton Stall Market, reopening their outdoor market in the Seaport District in May 2021. Fulton Stall Market is a nonprofit, indoor, public farmers market. It offers locally grown and produced, healthy and affordable, fresh food to the Seaport and Lower Manhattan community. Fulton Stall Market is a direct sales outlet for over 100 New York region farmers and small batch independent food producers. They have been operating as a public market to serve the Seaport community since 2015. While you shop at Fulton Stall Market, you can pick up a few guides from Escape Maker's informational kiosk. Escape Maker connects urbanites with local farm, winery, craft beverage, and culinary getaways within a day's drive or train ride of New York City. Learn about day trips from New York, where you can explore the best agritourism the region has to offer. Learn more at fultonstallmarket.org and escapemaker.com.
Okay, we're back and we're talking about the food of the Gitano or the gypsies of Spain. And Valerio, I want to know, like, what did you find out about the food? What types of food? What were they eating? What was going on? What were they cooking?
All right, yeah. So I was able to kind of put together everything I found and break it into like a few different bullets, let's call them. So I guess the easiest way, always entering food when you're talking about food or flavor, is to just look at ingredients. And there was a few different ingredients that five kind of categories in general that are kind of the mainstays or the flavor breakdowns of what the Catalan Gitano cuisine was like. So first and foremost, I would be remiss. It's actually crazy that it took me this long to even bring up this word, but is fennel. There's literally a phrase in Gitano communities that they say, what a Gitano dish, when they eat the flavor of it, or when they taste it, because it has such intense flavor of fennel. It grows wild throughout the region, and so it's therefore super easily foraged. And it's a lot of dishes, and a lot of the recipes that I collected are going to be kind of trademarked by this anisey, fennel-y flavor, which was great news for me because it happens to be one of my favorites. The second ingredient that we're going to see a lot of is chicken or hens. These, of course, pack a lot of punch, super reliable flavor as far as growing and raising chicken. Pretty relative, easily upkeep. And then they can also be extremely versatile. So there's a lot of different ways you can like repurpose a chicken. And then not only are you using the meat, but you have the bones to make stock. So like one chicken can actually kind of take you a very long way, which is what makes it popular in their cuisine. Next would be pork, I would say, is kind of the third most important ingredient. Again, super easy to keep, rich in flavor, cheap. The bones are also useful for stocks. And then because this is Spain, you have the pork meat, but then you have all the kind of related products. In Spain, they're called embutidos. So this is like blood sausage and chorizo, which again are extremely cheap to make, using kind of different parts of the animal and then spicing them with most often paprika.
All right.
So fish is one category that you're not going to see a lot of usage in their cuisine. But where I was in Catalonia is a water region or touches the ocean. So there you get a lot of something called bacalao, which is salted codfish that's preserved in salt and therefore like almost non-perishable. So you're able to keep fish year round outside of the fridge, because it's pretty much been had the moisture completely sucked out of it. In order to prepare it and cook it, you have to soak it in water for 24 hours, changing out the water every few hours. So therefore all the salt comes out, it gets kind of moisturized again, and you're able to cook it. So there is that the bacalao is the only time you're really going to see fish come into play. And then the last, ingredient that there's a lot of examples of these appearing in recipes are legumes. And you're going to, like I said with earlier ones, super nutritious, they're cheap, very easy to transport, keep you full for a long time, and extremely versatile. So you can match legumes with rice, pasta, potatoes. A lot of the Gitano cuisine is very stew-based. So you're going to see, they're called like potajes in Spanish. So lots of like big pots to serve large quantities of people filled with fennel and beans and bits of pork and chicken, maybe even bacon. These kind of huge group dinners.
I would say something to feed a lot of people.
Right? Something to feed a lot of people. My mom always says like food that sticks to your bones, right? So this like very rich, comforting, grounding food.
So they would use their starches of preference, or are what was also in the cuisine already. A lot of rice and potatoes.
Lots of rice. And just to kind of reiterate again, it's that eating style that you're going to see is super important. Even the cookbook that I was referencing, the one written by the Alicia Foundation, was divided not into like appetizers, mains, blah, 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 but was actually divided into like foods you eat with a spoon, foods you eat with a fork, and foods you eat with a knife. Because foods you eat with a spoon are going to be all these like very rich soups and stews. Foods you eat with a fork are like rice dishes, which are very popular in Spain as well. And rice can mean anything from like a paella to almost more of a soupy rice. And then foods you eat with a knife are like meats and kind of grilled foods. But this one, the main kind of preference or style of eating is always going to be from a big pot. And they say, cuchara y paso atrás, which means take a spoon and pass it on. So oftentimes you're having the big pot, you scoop yourself a bowl and you pass the pot on, and people it moves down from there.
Right.
But kind of like a lot of things we've been saying, it's this sense again of community and support and sharing and kind of convivial lifestyle.
Right. You know, I've seen a picture of you cooking with some of the women, and that's one thing I wanted to ask: who does most of the cooking?
It's a female. It's mostly a
culture. Female culture.
Yeah, culture. I talked to one woman whose name is Paquita Domingo, who's a huge cook. And she was even telling, she says it's always passed down to the oldest woman, and that she grew up not liking to cook. And the day her mom died, she stepped into the kitchen, and now she was one of the biggest contributors to the cookbook. She says she's always cooking for her family. In fact, there are even a few factors that most define the Gitano cuisine, and women is always going to be one of them. It's a huge, huge thing to consider when thinking about just passing of the recipes, codification of the recipes, and making of them in general.
Yeah. Well, the picture I saw of you, I think it was a picture that you had given another group. It was you standing in the kitchen with two or three women, older women, all cooking together. You know, in a restaurant kitchen, but a modern kitchen, a lot of, the counters, the stoves. And yet these dishes that you described to me, some of the big stews, I could also envision them being cooked in a big, iron kettle over an open fire.
Totally. They have a very kind of rustic feel to them. Mm-hmm. There's one recipe that I like to reference sometimes, and it's so interesting. It's basically they take just flour, add it to a pot and knead it with water, and then actually cook a stew around that. So once you have the ball of dough in the bottom of the pot, they start adding broth and vegetables on top of it. And it turns into this like stew with almost like a ball of bread at the middle of it. And yeah, it's this very kind of like cauldron over fire energy that you can imagine. And then you get everyone around and you get to taste it and share it with a huge group of people.
Well, like a giant dumpling in the bottom of the pot.
Yeah, kind of, right?
Yeah. But at the same time, some of that flour would I'm sure, dissolve off and help thicken
exactly.
the stew. Yeah.
Exactly.
Interesting. I like that idea. That's very interesting.
Yeah. Like you mentioned, besides women, there's just another really interesting point that I learned about. There's a few factors that kind of define the cuisine in general. So we said women, which you were super quick to point out, and very correct as well to point out. There's a few other things that kind of influence it as well. We're going to have to always account for migration. So because of the way that Roma communities traveled throughout Europe, though most of them are settled at this point, or pretty much all of them are settled, because of that history of constant movement, you are going to see a little bit of kind of a rich like mixture of traditions and customs. Another thing that's really important to take into account is generational interaction, which kind of links back to the idea of women, like we were discussing earlier. So whether it's through marriage or it's family intermingling, it's this passing of recipes through women of the family. And that's pretty much how a lot of this culinary know-how is kept alive, mm-hmm. Which isn't unlike a lot of other right. of other communities.
Exactly, from mother to daughter, you know.
Exactly, mm-hmm. And it's which is why I think that there's kind of this interesting tension that exists with projects like what I want to do or what I do, and this book, this cookbook with the Alicia Foundation, because it's in one sense it's really good because you are kind of taking all these recipes, giving them a place to live, writing them down for the first time, but it does in some ways feel like cheating that kind of secret silent bond that exists between generations. And it feels like stepping in between, but it is also, it's an act of preservation. So you, in one sense, it is also super important.
Yeah, no, I think it's very important work because how do we know about any culture, 500 years ago, if we're lucky, we look at some documents that show evidence of what they were eating, what they were cooking.
Exactly.
That tells us so much about where they lived, they farmed. I mean, I think it's a very important thing to do this archiving and the process of collecting, talking to the people, getting the background and the history from them. Yes, we still have in many cultures, the oral tradition of passing down recipes, and often a lot gets lost because maybe, in this modern society, maybe it skips a generation,
Right.
Somebody, as you said, the woman wasn't really interested in the kitchen, but
right.
she had to step into it. What if, in fact, she got a job as a data inputter or something?
And exactly.
She had no time to cook. So I think the project is of studying this is whether, I don't think you're cheating at all. I think that you can be the outsider looking in. One can be an outsider looking in, but yet put it down and document it.
Totally, totally. And I think that there's a lot of anxiety, especially about younger generations and just not being as interested in this or mm-hmm. being too busy or having other things to do. And there is kind of this, it does feel like, I don't know if it's because of the internet or something, but it does feel a little bit of a drop-off point. And so it's this kind of interesting tension, but the woman that I was talking about earlier, Paquita, has a quote that I wrote down that kind of sums all this up. And she says, when I was talking to her, she told me, I asked her about whether she thought recipes were important and food were important to understanding her and her identity. And she said, and I quote, "My culture is very based on food. It's super important. If we don't conserve it, I would lose my identity. I believe in values and principles. These are values we need. Otherwise, we would lose our identity. It's our way of understanding the world. It's our love. It's our dedication to our elders. If we promote our culture, we become more visible." So I think especially when we're talking about communities like these, like Gitanos, who on one hand have experienced a history of oppression, and then on the other hand are fearful of losing their traditions to modernity, you very much get people like her who are kind of filled with this anxiety and nervous about, wait, if this goes away, first of all, so does my history, but also mm-hmm. this is something that I can actually really use to help people who are not in my community gain access to it or understand it.
Absolutely, yeah.
Because if you sit down and you like the way it tastes, you're probably going to also like me, hopefully.
That's right. Well, it's a lot of observations were made during the period of COVID, and that a lot people were turning back to cooking food
right.
and making their own breads and making, going back to really base projects and learning a lot about their families, about their background and what they, the kind of food they like to eat, what makes them, what gives them an identity. And I just love that quote because it speaks so loudly to about so many people. But tell me about, first of all, there's a question I had earlier when you were talking about it. And that is some of these wonderful stews that you described. And I'm sure they vary with all the different ingredients. What about other vegetables? You have fennel. You talked about What about other greens and vegetables? Anything in particular, like foraging? Does that play large or?
Yeah. So I wouldn't say vegetables are going to be taking the lead anywhere soon. Okay. We can see like lots of good Spanish cooking. They use a sofrito as the base of a lot of their dishes. So that's going to be celery, or sorry, in Spain, it's onion, pepper, and garlic, mm-hmm. red pepper. So you see some of those. Oftentimes in the stews, you'll get carrots and celery and some cabbage as well. But fennel is really going to be the one green that's taking the lead. In general, Gitano food tends to be meat-based and oftentimes on the heavier side. Mm-hmm. Actually, in Spain, which this is not what my research went into, but it was just something that I learned along the way. I was more interested in the historical side of things, but there actually is an obesity problem in the community. And that was kind of why the Alicia Foundation originally started working with Gitano communities. And then they realized there was this really beautiful historical discourse to be had. So they kind of went more with that route. But even then they were saying, when I talked to the Alicia Foundation and I was saying, okay, if like obesity or child nutrition was your focus, why then did you take the time to kind of do this entire backlog of recipes? And they basically said to me, they were like, it's futile to try and work with a community and quote unquote better or help them improve certain habits if you don't understand the history. And to do it coming out of nowhere makes no sense. But if you can have a context for understanding why things are the way they are, and also just and then improve, not improving, but working with that to make something different, it's going to be a lot more successful than just coming in and changing things completely.
Right. Absolutely.
So that was a really interesting kind of element of their work with the Gitano communities as well.
Right. Another question I had for you on this was, did you notice or have you noticed or maybe haven't had the opportunity has their food migrated at all into mainstream Spanish cooking?
Yeah, that's a good point. No, not really. I think that there are other parts of, for example, in Eastern Europe or in the Balkans where it almost feels like the Roma culture in those areas is almost like more commodified, and you can go to like gypsy style restaurants where they play you certain music and feed you certain dishes. It doesn't feel as like there's as much of a back and forth in that way in Spain. And the food is pretty similar. I mean, there's certain dishes that you could see from Gitano cooking that you'd be like, oh, for sure, this is for sure different. But I wouldn't say that there was kind of that opposite direction. I mean, Spaniards tend to be quite religious about their food. So in general, there's not a lot of influence happening there.
Yeah, interesting. Very interesting. I find the whole thing fascinating because of, you know, the trials and tribulations they've gone through and, you know, finally finding a home. But still, what's the tension like today for a lot of these groups? Well, you know, specifically in Spain, what... are they feeling more assimilated? Do they want to be? Is there a bit of a fear of prosecution? Is anything, what's it like?
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's super great. The people that I talked to talked of like lots of different types of institutional violence. The woman Paquita Domingo told me that she had a really hard time finding a job. And then also like, extra levels of screening. She says she encounters lots of different types of prejudice. Mm-hmm. The neighborhood that I had to travel to one day, I went to a Roma community center or Gitano community center in Barcelona. Like a lot of the people, when I told them what neighborhood I was going to, were like kind of reacted in a certain way. So I wouldn't say, it doesn't feel at all like there's a huge kind of comfortable integration in any way.
Yeah. Well, and by the same token, things that I have read and heard that they're very closed too. They're very timid about letting somebody in.
Totally.
Study them, right? So yeah, when you first brought this project to the culinary historians of New York, a couple of us looked at one another and said, well, how is he going to gain entry into some of these
communities? This a lot. Yeah. and I think that, like, yes, I think that's a super valid point. And a lot of people through, because even when I was talking about this before, even talking to culinary historians of New York, I just remember a lot of people being like, how do you think you're going to do this? And yeah. I do, it is. I think also, especially when you have a community that has a history of external, like, violence towards right. them, it makes right. sense that you would start to close yourself off to outsiders. But right. I do think that if, then maybe this is like me in my like little brain and world that I've created for myself, but like, I do think if it's food that you're talking about, like, it's the easiest way to make someone's guards come down as fast as possible. And like, in my experience, like working with people or meeting people, if I can just know a few dishes about where they're from or describe to them a food I had that reminds me of where they are, like, I just notice that it makes people, it just melts people in a way that makes them feel super comfortable. And if you can actually express genuine interest, which is what I did have for this project, I think that people will, I don't know, there's just something that it just pushes a button and it just clicks really easily. And as soon as I mean, at first when I was meeting with different organizations in Barcelona, they were like, you want to what? And then I was like, yeah, I just want to meet a few, I would love if you could help me and like meet some people. I would love to cook with them. And they were like, okay, this is like kind of a difficult community for you to do that with. But then kind of once I met the Alicia Foundation, they had kind of massaged those connections already. And by the time I was calling and meeting with people, they were super excited. And yeah, I mean, once you get someone talking about a recipe or a flavor that means something to them or their child or their favorite thing to cook on Sundays when their whole family comes over, like, who isn't in a good mood when they're talking
right,
about that?
Right. And you show interest in them, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. And it ultimately, like, was something that was really undergirding my research and my thinking in general was like, yes, by paying attention to this or by putting value on what someone eats, you're therefore calling them valuable. Because it's, I mean, at least to me, it's a huge part of who someone is. And if you show respect and kind of devotion to something like that, it transfers onto them.
Yes. Well, I hope that, I mean, first of all, you're so fortunate to have gotten connected with that Alicia Foundation.
And, yeah, incredible.
And I hope that this is something that you will revisit and continue at some point in your travels, because what you have done so far is such a tremendous contribution, I think, to, you know, to cultural history, to culinary history. I mean, just knowing so much about a group of people, more so than anyone else, and especially a group of people that has been very elusive to the outside world. And I look forward to hearing more from you sometime in the future and hope that this can be a larger project. And thank you for spending your time with us to share this information that you did and put together.
Thank you. Yeah. I mean, it couldn't have been possible without the Culinary Historians of New York. Like, they, I mean, this was something that was just like a passion project of mine that I've been telling people at dinner parties that I wanted to do. And so with their help, it kind of really opened a lot of doors. And then also with the help of the Alicia Foundation and all the Gitano people, specifically Paquita Domingo, that they introduced me to. I emailed, because I presented this recently to the culinary historians, and I emailed the presentation to my contacts at the Alicia Foundation. And I told them, because we had talked about it briefly, they were like, if we ever do this on a Spanish, like across the country, I was like, you have to call me, because I will drop whatever I'm doing and I will get in that car and I will drive with you guys to make like a larger cookbook happen. So I told him, I was like, here's my number, here's my email. When you want to do this project, let me, you know who to call.
That's the way it happens, Valerio.
Let's see.
You got to keep at it. That's all. Got to keep at them. Well, thank you so much. And feel free to share, you know, this podcast with them so they can, you know, hear more of your
yes,
views.
Yes, I will.
With it.
I will.
And as I said before, I hope to hear more from you in the future. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening. And this has been, again, another Taste of the Past. And be sure to subscribe to A Taste of the Past so you don't miss any of these wonderful conversations. And If you get a chance to go to the website, I don't know where you come across this podcast, but if you come across the podcast through heritageradionetwork.org, you might take a look at some of the other programming. And while you're there, take a look at the beating heart in the upper right-hand corner and give us a little love. Thank you again for listening.
A Taste of the Past is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like. Tell your friends. And please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.